We are ready to proceed with the second matter on our oral argument calendar today. Council's doing what they should do, which is settling themselves in. I'll ask the marshal to call the second case, please, for the record.
A-918-2080, State of Minnesota, respondent,
And I'll just make a few preliminary remarks, Council. While you settle in, please just go right ahead and get yourselves comfortable. First of all, we're looking forward to hearing your arguments today. We do have all of the briefs and are ready to listen. I want to just remind you of a few things that you may be well aware of, but I'll just make sure that you think about them before you start speaking. So first of all, when you get to the podium, make sure you make whatever adjustments you'd like, both of the microphone as well as the height of the lectern. And then if you would identify yourself for the record, yourself personally, as well as the client that you represent. That will keep our record clear. So with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Max Keller, M-A-X-K-E-L-L-E-R. I represent the appellant, Masoud Amin. Unfortunately, what we have in this case is a miscarriage of justice, a slew of errors. You might say, in the words of Paul Newman and Cool Hand Luke, you might say what we have is a failure to communicate. One of the biggest problems in this case that I see is that the state was arguing that Dr. Amin could not present evidence that someone else was responsible for producing forged documents, that is, creating a forgery. And this was characterized by the state as alternative perpetrator evidence, and I've been down this road as a trial attorney myself, so it seems to me like what the trial court should have said, and this is the failure to communicate, is you can say that you're not responsible for forging the documents. And of course, he wasn't charged with forgery, but he's charged with uttering. In order to utter, you have to know that the document was forged. So it does matter, like, who forged it or if he forged it or not. It does matter as far as intent.
Aren't those two different questions?
Which questions, Your Honor?
Well, I think I can understand why if someone forged the document, that might be relevant to their knowledge of whether uttering the document, whether that was a forged document that they uttered. But the other question, knowing who forged it, seems to be a very different question. And how does evidence relating to the identity of the person who forged the document show lack of knowledge that the document is forged?
Well, thank you for that question, Judge Bryan. So if he forged it, then obviously he knows that it was forged. If someone else forged it, he doesn't necessarily know, but then that just makes more questions. Like if he gave it to his friend Joe and he said, would you doctor this thing up, right? Then he would know it was forged. So it's all kind of intertwined to me, but I think that also kind of speaks to what I was getting to, is that if you say, I didn't forge this, I'm not charged with forgery, but I'm charged with uttering, so this does have to go with my intent. Now,
Let me rephrase it a little bit. It's illegal to pass a counterfeit $100 bill. Knowledge that it's fake is one of those same elements, just like uttering a forged document. How does knowing who created the $100 bill, how is that relevant to someone's knowledge of whether it's fake or not? The identity of who made it?
Well, I think it's a legitimate point. It's a legitimate question, but the problem is if a defendant forged something, the defendant knows that it was forged. The defendant doesn't have to know who forged it in order to be guilty of uttering, but it does go to the intent, because his position is that his ex-wife got into his mail and altered the document, put it back in the envelope, made it so that he's, you know, going through the mail, and he thinks that this legitimately came from Teocraft. And you know, this is one of the problems with this case, is that she had access to the mail the whole time. The mail was coming to the former marital address. So she did have access to it. She was offered electronic access to the accounts. So to me, the distinction that the trial court failed to make, which is the failure to communicate, is that the trial court should say, in any circumstance like this, you can say that you didn't forge it, so therefore you did not know that it was forged, so you did not have the intent to pass a forged document, whether it's a check or something else. You're only required, you're only put on an obligation under the rules of criminal procedure to follow the alternative perpetrator rules if you say that person forged it.
Well, I mean, I understand the argument that you're making, and it's an important distinction that if you're raising a defense that negates an element of the offense, that's separate and distinct from an alternative perpetrator.
Exactly.
The issue here, though, is you have an aggravated forgery charge, which could include forging a document, or it could include passing a forged document or uttering it. There are two different theories that could support that kind of a charge. So I guess my question is, what role or what impact does it have if the attempt or the theory by which the defense seeks to negate an element is simultaneously also a theory by which someone else committed forgery or committed aggravated forgery, the charged offense? Does that have any role in the district court's determination about how to characterize this?
Well, the district court clearly thought it was alternative perpetrator and required, you know, following the state's lead. And so the trial court said, you have to disclose all this or you're going to be prohibited from bringing this defense, which, as you just said, Judge Bryan, our position is the defense was negating an element of the crime, not...
Also, at the same point, was presenting evidence to a jury that someone else committed aggravated forgery. It's both. You're using it to negate an element, and let's assume for the moment that I agree that knowledge of who forged it could go to the element of passing a forged document. Let's assume I agree with you on that point. Even if that's true, the evidence that you're using to negate knowledge is simultaneously evidence that someone else committed this charged offense.
Well, I'm not sure that I agree with that. Now, what you were stating, Judge Bryan, is that there's two alternative theories, if I understand what you said, by which the defendant could be guilty.
No, that's not what I said. I said there's two different theories of how somebody can commit
the
charged offense.
Yeah, the state
one theory is the theory that the state has about your client. The other theory is the theory that the defendant had at trial about his ex-wife. Both are theories of how to commit this charged offense.
Right.
So that's why my question is, if you have an offense like that, what role does that play in the court's characterization of this as either alternative perpetrator defense or lack of knowledge?
Well, since the state's theory, Your Honor, was not that the defendant appellant, Dr. Amin, actually forged the documents, and they absolutely cannot prove that, which is part of the argument in our brief. Dave Curris, the fraud examiner, said that, you know, somebody altered this, somebody committed a forgery, but he has no idea who did it. So, you know, our position is the state's theory was never that he was being prosecuted for making a forgery, for making a false document. He was being prosecuted for offering or uttering. And so if someone else did it, it's not actually, if someone else created a false document, that's not actually alternative perpetrator, because that's not the crime that he was charged with. So that's another reason why the trial court erred in saying you must disclose all this as alternative perpetrator evidence. Our position is, along with what we were just talking about, that this is a circumstantial evidence case. Obviously, because we're talking about the intent of the person who's passing the altered or forged information, you can't really say that it could be anything other than circumstantial evidence unless you have some document where he said, oh, I have the intent to pass a forged document. So, of course, the standard of review under Al-Nasir is that the conviction cannot be upheld by this court unless there's no other rational hypothesis to explain the circumstances other than the defendant appellant's guilt, and we assert that there is other rational hypotheses, such as that someone got into his mail and put the forged document in there, and if it was just me living at home and no one else has access to my mail, well, maybe that's too much of a stretch, but here the testimony is all the retirement documents were being sent to the former marital address where Ms. Ambrose, his ex-wife, was still living.
Mr. Keller, would you agree that in the divorce proceeding, the documents, the forged documents, would create an advantage to the husband and a disadvantage to the wife?
Well, that's another thing that I wanted to talk about, Judge Bryan. So one thing is we made it clear in our brief that she was the beneficiary.
Well, that's not quite the question I'm asking. I'm asking if you look at, in terms of property division, determining the value of property, isn't it worse for her to take the numbers and the calculations, if you will, from the forged documents and better for her to use the numbers from the actual
documents? The short answer is yes, but then, of course, Dr. Amin and his counsel, in the divorce proceedings, they said, oh, well, we made a mistake. These are actually the right numbers right here. So if he's really trying to perpetrate a fraud, then why would he self-disclose?
Right, but I guess my question is, you bring up the rational hypothesis standard, is to review whether it's reasonable to think that the wife would do something to her disadvantage in the divorce case. Why is that a reasonable alternative hypothesis in this case?
Well, what I would say, Your Honor, is she could figure that the true numbers are always going to come out because she was offered access to the true numbers and she had direct access to the true numbers since all the mail was coming to her. And so she could put in false documents in there. She could make him look like a liar to the divorce court. She could get him charged with a felony. And she could still produce the true numbers because she had the true numbers coming in the mail to her, and she had offered access. She was offered access by Dr. Amin to, like, the username and the password so she could log on to the accounts on the internet and she could see the numbers. So I do think there are other rational hypotheses other than the defendant's guilt.
So, Mr. Keller, if I could take you to another issue. I was struggling reading this to understand your legal impossibility defense that you were saying the jury instructions deprived your client of the ability to make. And it seemed what you were saying was it would be legally impossible to swindle yourself of your own money. Does that mean that kind of these swindles until there's actually a decision by the district court judge in the marital, dividing the marital property, that there's no possibility of swindles, there's no possibility of forgery? I just need your help.
I understand what you're saying, Judge Justin, so thanks for that question. It may not be our strongest argument, but it is true that at the time that the evidence, say the disclosures, were exchanged by the parties in the divorce, there was no determination yet of how the distribution of assets was going to be made. So you can't steal something that belongs to you or maybe partially belongs to you. That's kind of what our argument is.
Your impossibility defense is limited to count one, which is an attempted theft by swindle. And I think, haven't we held before that you can't have an impossibility defense to an attempted offense?
That may be the case. As I said, it's not necessarily our strongest argument, but we could talk about what follows on from that, which is the jury instructions and the statements during closing argument. So, of course, the state goes up there and says, he confessed to this in the divorce case. Well, that's not true. And that's extremely prejudicial, extremely inflammatory thing to go up there and say, well, the defendant confessed to this in another case. Then, best I can figure, the trial counsel was...
Can I interrupt briefly? And I know your time's running out. So just to clarify, are you saying that there should have been a mistrial, or are you saying, or that we should remand for new trial because of misconduct, or are you saying there was error in the court's denial of the rebuttal?
Both, Your Honor. The problem, I think, is that when you look at this as an appellate court, there's a little bit of a stumbling block because somebody might say, well, they didn't actually object during the closing argument. They objected after the closing argument, which is the part that I was about to mention is I'm afraid that the trial counsel was too polite and they were following the old admonition that you're not supposed to object to people's closing arguments. And there's something to be said for that for the sake not of politeness, but because juries don't necessarily like it, especially if the trial court overrules the objection. But then the problem, of course, is it's to the prejudice of Dr. Amin, because then the state can argue that, well, they didn't actually object during the closing argument. They objected afterwards. And then there's no record of the bench conference, which is what the state argued in their brief. It's true. This is one of the problems with just how things are done in court, basically, because really there should be a record made of all bench conferences, but it's technically difficult because then when you go back and you put it on the record later on, you're kind of making a sort of a summary or a paraphrasing of what was said up at the bench. It's not a literal recitation of what was said at the bench. I see my time is up.
And counsel, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sarah Vokes, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, appearing on behalf of the respondent, the state of Minnesota, in this matter. This court should affirm appellant's convictions because the evidence at trial was sufficient and the district court did not abuse its discretion in its rulings, both pretrial and during trial. Because appellant suffered no prejudice from the district court's rulings or the jury instructions or the prosecutor's statements, this court should affirm. At the outset, I can start with the issue of the alternative perpetrator issue that was raised. As was brought out during counsel's arguments, essentially here we have a theory of defense that is also potentially an alternative perpetrator defense. And so it's the state's position that the district court did not abuse its discretion in asking for appellant's trial counsel to make a showing so that the district court had adequate information to proceed in making rulings about what would be admissible during trial. That's what we like to see district courts doing ahead of trial, is litigating all of the pretrial evidentiary issues so that things go smoothly during trial. And here, obviously, how the appellate courts are typically looking at these cases is simply whether or not a district court abused its discretion in denying some alternative perpetrator evidence to be coming in. I think the issue raised here is a little different, just whether the district court should have required trial counsel to make that showing. There's not really case law about how you would review that particular decision of a trial court. But here, the district court determined that the defendant could produce alternative perpetrator evidence in regards to his family law lawyer if he wished to pursue that trial strategy. That was apparently abandoned before trial. The district court ruled that they could pursue any errors made by the retirement fund itself, as that would not truly be an alternative perpetrator. But finally, the district court did find that appellant had not made an adequate showing that EA could have been an alternative perpetrator. And here, I think that's based on the fact that the showing was essentially that EA may have had access to records and that there may have been some animus between the parties. And the district court found that that was not enough of a connection. Here, I think what the most important thing for this court to consider in this posture is simply that there is no prejudice. Appellant hasn't pointed to any specific evidence that was excluded that would have changed the outcome here. And instead, the district court did allow, prior to closing arguments, for appellant to argue in closing that EA, the alleged victim, was somehow the one who masterminded the offense itself. I know that in arguments, counsel is putting forward an argument that there was evidence that appellant, that EA was receiving the mail and could have made the forgery herself, but that's contrary to the record, wherein EA testified that she did not continue to receive his mail after he left the house. And so I think at this particular juncture, there's no evidence that appellant is pointing to that was excluded. He was still able to argue that argument in closing, that he had a lack of knowledge of the forgery itself because someone else could have done that forgery. Briefly, I can touch on the prosecutorial error that's been alleged. It's the state's position that this particular phrase, although it may have been inartful, it did not mischaracterize the evidence. It was not pervasive throughout the closing argument, and therefore the district court, in making her determination at the time, that it did not rise to the level of prosecutorial misconduct. Here in the state's brief, I did acknowledge the fact that an objection was made, but apparently immediately after the closing argument, but that no matter which analysis this court would use, that it would not be a reason to reverse. I would be more than happy to answer any questions that the court may have at this time. Otherwise, the state is content to rest on its brief.
Thank you very much, counsel. Any rebuttal, Mr. Keller?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So the state was just talking about the fact that they argued that Dr. Ambrose testified that she didn't get the mail after Dr. Amin left the house. Now, if you put it that way, my argument doesn't change. I just want to clarify this because then she's got all kinds of statements then in her possession, even up to the point that he left the house and they were physically separated, showing that the forged document numbers are not correct. So if she opened the mail, which she bizarrely testified that she threw it out or shredded it or something like that, but if she opened up his statements and looked at them, she would see that the numbers are not correct. And there's testimony that they had discussed their retirement accounts with each other many times. So when she says, oh, I didn't know there was three different accounts, that's not correct because they discussed it many times. I wanted to talk about closing arguments. So the defense was arguing that the state failed to prove the origin of the fraudulent documents like we were talking about before. And then the state objected that Dr. Amin's counsel was misstating the state's burden of proof. And the trial court sustained the objection. We think that's a major error. The trial court believed that the origin of the documents was irrelevant as a matter of law.
Well, and I mean, I just wanted to make sure I understand that, but isn't that because it's, you know, who forged the documents isn't necessary for any of those three convictions. Isn't that true?
It's not an element of the crime, which is what we were talking about.
Isn't that what the judge was saying there?
Well, I'm not sure what she had in her mind. I would say she didn't like this entire case, and it's extremely document-intensive case, extremely litigated, and she really didn't like the defense. She didn't like the defendant. She didn't like the defense counsel. Now, just because it's not an element of the crime, it doesn't mean that it isn't relevant, because what we're arguing in pages 33 and 34 is that it doesn't have to be an element of the crime. It goes to his intent, because he doesn't have to know, as Judge Bryan said, he doesn't have to know who forged it, but he does have to know that it's forged. So if you're the jury and you're trying to figure out, did this guy know what was going on? Well, it seems like it would be relevant as a jury to want to know, well, who forged it? It's not an element of the crime, but the state can present evidence on that. The state doesn't have to, but it could, and the defense can present evidence on that, and the defense can argue that, well, they never proved who forged it, so therefore they haven't proved that he knew it was forged. So just because it's not an element of the crime, it doesn't mean that it doesn't go to intent. And she was being mailed the documents, at least up until the time that he left the former marital home. So we would state that that was extremely prejudicial, that he was not allowed to talk about those things in closing argument, since the state never did link him to the creation of the forgery. And that goes to our argument that it's a circumstantial evidence case. It also goes to the prejudice during the objection in a closing argument. And then compounding the prejudice is the state going up there saying that, oh, he confessed to this, when we all know that he did not confess to it. So our position is that the state, of course, is here arguing that, well, there wasn't any errors, but if there were any errors, there's no prejudice. Of course, our argument is all of these things are prejudicial, and standing alone, some of them might not be enough to warrant reversal. But as we argued on page 36, of course, there is case law saying that you can reverse based on the cumulative effect of these errors, even if you thought that a single error or a couple errors is not enough to warrant reversal. So we'd ask that you reverse the convictions and also find that there was not enough evidence and therefore retrial would be barred under the Double Jeopardy Clause. Thank you.
Our thanks to counsel for the arguments that were presented here today. The matter is now submitted to this court for its decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. Thank you very much.